Imagine waking up, right? And the very first sensation you register is just, well, it's a complete and utter denial of your physical agency.
We're absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, yeah, you aren't just pinned under something heavy. You are entirely immobilized, encased in total darkness.
Right.
So you open your eyes, your brain is fighting through that thick, that fog of sleep inertia. And you realize you are staring up at a sheet of frosted glass resting near inches from your face.
Just right there.
Right there. You are inside a coffin.
Yeah, that primal panic just sets in immediately.
Exactly. And as that claustrophobia begins to suffocate you, your vestibular system kicks in. You feel a sway, like a mechanical rhythm. The coffin is moving.
So you're in transit.
Right. You're on a train hurtling through some unknown geography. But then comes the real paradigm shift. When you finally manage to break the seal of this box, you realize you aren't on a subway and you aren't even on Earth.
No, not even close.
No. You are plunging through the vacuum of deep space, and inexplicably, you are heavily armed, carrying this golden holographic hit list of ancient mythological targets.
It is just a phenomenal hijacking of a very mundane human experience.
Really is.
Because, I mean, we've all experienced that moment of waking up in a hotel room or, you know, after a really neat nap where the environment feels just slightly off.
Oh, yeah, where you don't know what year it is for a second.
Exactly. Your brain has to reboot its understanding of reality. And the author of this text takes that baseline vulnerability, that everyday sleep inertia, and just weaponizes it.
Completely.
They drop you into a scenario that shatters the laws of physics, theology, and frankly, genre in a matter of seconds.
And that is the precise terrain we're navigating today on this deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at a highly concentrated, incredibly dense narrative excerpt from a text titled Leteti Texti.
Which translates to attached text, right?
Yes, exactly. Attached text. And our mission today is to completely deconstruct this layered micro-narrative. We're going to analyze the mechanisms the author uses to seamlessly blend the gritty, decaying aesthetics of a noir thriller, right, of the cold isolation of hard science fiction.
And then violently collide both of those with the heavy symbolic weight of ancient biblical mythology.
Yes, it's such a wild mix. And, you know, for you listening, even though this is a fictional excerpt, analyzing how stories build suspense like this, how they blend genres, it's essentially a masterclass in creative thinking and understanding narrative structures.
Oh, 100%. And we're going to look specifically at how that collision operates on a mechanical level, because this isn't just a stylistic choice.
Right. It's structural.
Exactly. It's a structural architecture designed to keep the reader fundamentally unmoored. When you analyze a text that packs this much world building into just a few paragraphs, you are looking at incredible narrative efficiency.
Yeah, it's really the manipulation of audience expectations at its finest.
It is.
So I want to start right at the beginning with the anatomy of this sensory panic. The text introduces us to our protagonist, Samuel, who wakes up with a violent start inside this coffin-like pod.
Right.
And the sensory details are just immediately oppressive. He has to physically wipe the frosted glass with his hand just to see out.
Which tells us so much right away. Frosted glass implies a temperature differential, right?
Yeah, like his breath is condensing and freezing on the glass.
Exactly. It's tactile.
And what he sees through that smeared glass is a dim train carriage lit by these vague blue lamps glowing on the ceiling.
A very cold, sterile kind of lighting.
Right. But here is the detail that completely disrupts the scene for me. In the dim glow of those blue lamps, Samuel sees moths.
Yes. The moth.
Moths are fluttering around, bumping into each other. And I have to push back on the typical sci-fi reading here.
Okay, go ahead.
If you were in a high-tech stasis pod on a space train, the environment should be pristine, right? Putting moths in there feels less like a stylistic quirk and more like a deliberate contamination of the genre.
Oh, it is an absolute contamination. And that is precisely where the horror is generated in this opening.
Right.
Because true horror isn't necessarily created by just, you know, introducing a monster. It's created by the juxtaposition of the sterile and the decaying.
Wow, yeah.
Think about the physical mechanism of a stasis pod. It implies cryogenics, medical preservation, clinical control.
It's supposed to keep you safe, safe from time, safe from aging.
Exactly. It's an environment designed to halt biological degradation. But moths, fundamentally, they represent the exact opposite.
They're pests.
They are agents of decay. They feed on forgotten fabrics. They are drawn to dying, flickering light sources. You find them in attics, in abandoned houses.
Places that time has left behind.
Right. So by introducing moths into what should be a sterile cryogenic chamber, the author is signaling that the system is failing.
Ah, so they are signaling that the environment violates its own rules.
Precisely. When you put a moth inside a medical facility, you instantly corrupt the promise of safety that the facility is supposed to provide. The high-tech coffin is no longer a place of preservation. It has become a place of neglect.
That subtle biological intrusion just hacks your nervous system.
It really does. It tells you, before Samuel even fully realizes it, that whatever institution or power put him in that pod is either dead, dying, or just profoundly careless.
That completely reframes the entire opening for me. It's not a clean awakening. It's an awakening into ruin.
Yes.
And the physical reality of that ruin sets in immediately. So Samuel feels the train sway slightly and curve to the left.
Right, the kinesthetic detail.
Yeah, and when he tries to react to that movement, he discovers he's strapped down. But the author is very specific about the restraints here. He is strapped across his chest and his legs.
Which is terrifying.
It is. He feels around desperately in the dark, searching for a release mechanism, and he finds that there is no handle on the inside of the pod.
The absence of an internal handle is the ultimate removal of agency.
It transitions the pod from a medical device into a prison cell.
Exactly. But let's look at the specific anatomy of those restraints. Pinning the chest and the legs isn't just a random detail.
Why do you say that?
Well, the chest houses the lungs. Right. So restricting it triggers this primal mammalian fear of suffocation.
Oh, like sleep paralysis.
Very much like that. And then the legs, they are the engine of your flight response.
Right. You can't run.
So by neutralizing the breath and the ability to run, the author is attacking the two most basic biological imperatives for survival.
I'd even argue that the swaying of the train compounds that helplessness.
Oh, how so?
Well, if you are strapped down and you feel a vehicle curving to the left, you're experiencing lateral G-forces, right? Mm. Your inner ear registers the motion, but your visual cortex is trapped looking at frosted glass.
Oh, that disconnect.
Yeah. The disconnect between what Samuel feels and what he can actually see induces a kind of narrative motion sickness. It spikes the adrenaline because his body is being moved through space without his consent.
That kinesthetic empathy is critical here. The author forces you, the reader, to inhabit Samuel's physical panic. The text explicitly notes that he wipes the glass further, gasping for air as his heart pounds. We aren't observing his terror from a distance.
No, we're right there with him.
We are experiencing the restriction of the straps, the lack of oxygen, and that erratic pulse right alongside him.
But the narrative doesn't let him stay in that state of sheer panic, which I find really interesting.
Right.
This is where we learn the first crucial piece of information about who Samuel actually is, even if his own memory is completely fragmented. He forces himself to adapt.
Yes, he does.
Instead of thrashing against the straps until he exhausts himself, he consciously takes control of his autonomic nervous system.
Which is not a normal reaction.
Exactly. He tells himself to breathe calmly, he feels for his wrist, and he actively monitors his pulse until it slowly settles.
Right, and that is a highly specialized response. That is not how a regular civilian reacts to waking up buried alive.
No, I'd be screaming.
We all would. That is a trained tactical methodology. It implies military or intelligence conditioning.
Right.
He is overriding a biological panic response with procedural discipline. And that discipline is literally the only thing that allows him to perceive his environment clearly enough to find the exit.
And his forced calm allows him to notice a tiny detail on the glass. He sees a transparent plate embedded in the frost, and on this plate, there is writing in Hebrew.
A huge pivot.
Massive. Mm. He squints in the dim blue light, and he sounds it out syllable by syllable. Like, he goes, Reiki, Okie.
Yes.
And the instant he yells that word, the glass slides open, and the physical reality of the carriage violently shifts.
This is the primary threshold of the text. It's the exact moment the genre fractures.
Yeah, tell me about that.
To understand the mechanics of this shift, we have to analyze that linguistic trigger. Reikia is not just some random sequence of letters functioning as a sci-fi passcode.
Right.
In biblical Hebrew, Reikia is the word used in the Genesis creation narrative. It translates to the firmament.
The firmament being the dome that separates the heavens from the earth.
Yeah,
right.
Precisely. In ancient cosmological models, the firmament was conceived as this vast, solid dome, like beaten out like metal, that God placed on the second day of creation to separate the waters above from the waters below.
So it's literal architecture.
It is the physical architecture of the sky.
So we are looking at a linguistic mechanism where speaking the ancient word for the sky literally commands the physical sky to appear.
Exactly.
But I have to ask, how is this functioning within the world of the story? Like, are we dealing with an invocation of ancient magic where words hold esoteric power? Or is Rakia functioning as a highly advanced biometric voice command? Because those are two very different operational realities.
I would argue the author is deliberately collapsing the boundary between the two.
Oh, interesting.
Think about how modern coding languages work, right? Mm. We use specific syntax to command machines to alter physical realities.
Like opening a smart door or launching a rocket.
Exactly. In this universe, ancient Hebrew seems to function as the root code of reality itself. It's the concept of the performative utterance. A word that doesn't just describe a thing, but actually does the thing.
Oh, like let there be light.
Yes. Just as let there be light is a command that generates photons, shouting Rakia functions as a mechanical override that generates the sky.
And the text really supports that mechanical interpretation with its sound design.
Yes, the sounds are key.
Because the moment he yells the word, it doesn't describe some mystical, ethereal vanishing.
No.
It describes a heavy industrial sound. The text says, a click, click room echoes from the carriage walls.
Right.
It sounds like massive gears disengaging and heavy motors firing up.
It grounds the mythological word in heavy machinery, and the result of that machinery operating is just staggering.
Yeah.
The roof of the carriage retracts, completely exposing the interior.
And what it exposes is the ultimate rug pull. The roof retracts, and Samuel is looking up at a starry sky.
But not just any sky.
Right. It's not a night sky over a terrestrial landscape.
Yeah.
He specifically identifies the blue constellation of the Pleiades and a brightly shining nebula among the stars.
Yeah.
The train is not on Earth. It is plunging through deep space.
And the psychological whiplash of that environmental shift, I mean, it cannot be overstated.
It's dizzying.
You are taking a character and a reader who has just acclimated to the ultimate claustrophobia of a sealed coffin, right?
Yeah.
And you instantly hurl them into the ultimate agoraphobia of an infinite vacuum.
Oh, that's such a good way to put it. Claustrophobia to agoraphobia.
The scale shifts from inches to light years in a fraction of a second.
And Samuel is entirely physically unprepared for that scale.
Completely.
He manages to climb out of the open coffin, and the text notes he is practically naked and feeling chilly.
Which is an understatement.
Yeah. If you are suddenly exposed to the ambient temperature of a nebula, chilly feels like a massive understatement.
Sure.
But the visual design of the carriage heightens this exposure even more. The floor and the walls of the carriage are black and translucent, and they are reflecting the starry sky above.
That architectural detail is so insidious.
Why?
Because by making the floor translucent and reflective, the author dissolves the ground beneath Samuel's feet.
Oh, God, yeah.
He isn't just looking up at the cosmos. The cosmos is beneath him. It's surrounding him.
Like walking on glass over a skyscraper, but worse.
Much worse. It creates a terrifying optical illusion of freefall. He basically appears to be floating naked in a glass box in the middle of a stellar void.
It strips away the final illusion of safety. Because if the floor reflects the void, there is no foundation.
Exactly.
But standing naked and freezing in a translucent space train isn't a survivable state. The sheer hostility of the environment forces him out of shock and into action.
Right. The survival instinct kicks back in.
Yeah. He needs thermal protection, and he needs to figure out how to defend himself against whatever put him there in the first place. And this necessity drives him to explore the carriage, which leads him straight to the armory.
And the contents of that armory introduced the second major genre collision of the text.
Oh, I love this part.
He moves from biological vulnerability to tactical agency, but the tools provided to him, they complicate our understanding of the universe even further.
Let's look at the mechanics of this armory. So he spots a large black metallic cabinet built into the wall. On the front is an electronic plate displaying the number 12 in red.
Okay.
He touches the plate. It makes an electronic chirp. And the doors pull open automatically, revealing an interior lit by blue lights.
The aesthetics here are heavily stylized.
Very.
It's almost pulling from cyberpunk visual language. The stark black metal, the glowing red digits, the cold blue interior lighting.
Yeah, it feels like a video game.
Exactly. It's designed to look hyper-modern, efficient, and lethal.
But the gear hanging in those blue lights is incredibly contradictory.
Yeah, so contradictory.
Inside this voice-activated, space-faring, high-tech locker, he finds a white space-style suit.
Which makes sense.
Right. That tracks perfectly. He needs pressure and thermal regulation in space.
Yeah.
But layered with that spacesuit is a black bulletproof vest.
Yeah.
And hanging beneath it is a tactical belt equipped with a standard 9mm pistol in a holster, loaded with heavy magazines.
It is a profound anachronism.
I look at this loadout, and it feels like putting a standard padlock on a bank vault made of reinforced glass.
That's a great analogy.
It just protects against the entirely wrong kind of threat. If you are operating the vacuum of deep space with technology advanced enough to build translucent star trains, why on earth are you arming your operatives with a kinetic gunpowder-based 9mm pistol?
Right.
Where are the directed energy weapons? A 9mm bullet in space feels functionally useless.
Why do you say that?
Well, if you puncture an enemy's spacesuit, the vacuum of space will kill them long before the blood loss from a 9mm round does.
That is a highly logical observation, which means we have to analyze why the author specifically chose this weaponry.
It can't just be an oversight.
No, it isn't a mistake. It's a thematic statement.
Okay.
A 9mm pistol and a Kevlar vest are tools of localized intimate violence.
Yeah, like SWAT gear.
Exactly. They are designed for close quarters urban combat. So by equipping Samuel with these specific tools, the author is communicating the exact nature of the threat he is about to face.
You're suggesting the enemy doesn't fight with lasers or ship-to-ship torpedoes.
Exactly. The vest implies that whoever he is fighting uses physical projectiles. They shoot kinetic bullets.
Yeah.
They engage in close-range firefights. It grounds the sprawling cosmic sci-fi setting in a brutal, gritty, militaristic reality.
That's fascinating.
Furthermore, relying on gunpowder and lead in a hyper-advanced setting suggests a universe where technology might be highly advanced in terms of transit and cryogenics.
But combat hasn't evolved.
Yes. Or maybe it has regressed or remained anchored in visceral physical trauma. It removes the clean, sterilized distance of a laser blast and forces the combat to be bloody, loud, and physically intimate.
That makes the reality of his situation so much darker.
It does.
He isn't an explorer charting a nebula. He is an assassin or a soldier drafted into a trench war that just happens to be taking place among the stars.
Beautifully put.
And the organizational structure of this war is hinted at through the branding on his gear. The cabinet was marked with a red 12, right?
Right.
And as he continues searching the locker, he finds a strange case attached to the belt.
The controller.
Yes.
This is where the text begins to weave theology directly into the tactical hardware.
Right. So he pulls out a device that looks like a heavy remote controller. He presses a button, and it lights up blue with red keys. And on the bottom edge of this controller is a small engraved plate that reads 12 disciples.
Let's analyze the semiotics of that label.
Please do.
In Western literature and historical theology, the number 12 is arguably the most potent symbol of cosmic order and divine administration.
Right, like the tribes of Israel.
Exactly. You have the 12 tribes representing the foundation of the Old Covenant and the 12 apostles representing the foundation of the New.
So it's a structural number.
Yes. It signifies a complete, divinely sanctioned governing structure.
But mapping that holy structure onto a literal piece of hardware like a controller with red keys is deeply unsettling.
Oh, very much so.
What is he actually controlling? If he has a 12 disciples controller, does that mean he is directing a swarm of 12 autonomous drones?
Maybe.
Or is it a navigation protocol for the train? Or is it a communication device linking him to 11 other assassins?
See, the ambiguity is the point. But the implication is undeniable. Samuel is operating under a chain of command that utilizes the nomenclature of religious fundamentalism. It elevates his loadout from standard military issue to something dogmatic.
Yeah.
He isn't just following orders from a general. The hardware itself implies he is executing a mandate that considers itself holy.
It literalizes the concept of a crusade.
Exactly. A literal crusade in space.
And you can feel Samuel's psychological shift as he interacts with this gear.
Yes, the physical action.
Right. He presses the button, turns the controller off, and calmly stows it away. He proceeds to put on the white suit, strap the black vest over his chest, and secure the 9mm to his hip. The physical act of putting on armor is a profound psychological threshold.
It really is. It is the transition from prey to predator.
Wow, yeah.
Think about it. The vest replaces the restrictive straps of the coffin.
Oh, that's a great parallel.
He is reclaiming the physical space of his body. By arming himself, he integrates with the logic of the train. He accepts that violence is the required currency of this environment.
But accepting the necessity of violence is one thing. Discovering who you are supposed to inflict it upon is another entirely.
Very true.
And the final items Samuel discovers in the armory push this narrative past the realm of gritty sci-fi and plunge it straight into literalized myth.
Right. We move from the tactical utility of the 9mm to the absolute surrealism of the targets.
So Samuel notices a specialized shoulder pocket on his spacesuit. The exterior of the pocket bears a golden shield, and pinned to that shield is a white heart jewelry pin.
Okay.
The pocket is bulging. He unseals it and pulls out a deck of cards. But it's not a standard paper deck.
No.
It is a solid gold deck of cards, heavy and metallic, with a bright red heart enameled in the center.
The sensory contrast here is vital to the story.
How so?
Up to this moment, the text is focused on industrial utilitarian textures.
Right. Frosted glass, cold metal cabinets.
Synthetic spacesuits, Kevlar, gunmetal, and suddenly the author introduces an object of extreme, almost decadent luxury.
A golden shield, a jewelry pin, a solid gold deck.
Exactly.
It feels completely incongruous with a military loadout. I mean, if you are prepping for a firefight, a heavy block of solid gold is just dead weight.
Right. It has no tactical advantage.
It serves absolutely no tactical purpose.
Which means its purpose is entirely symbolic and hierarchical. It introduces the aesthetics of a high roller casino, of royalty, of immense wealth, directly into a combat zone.
That's so weird.
It tells us that the forces behind Samuel's mission operate with unlimited resources and a penchant for theatricality.
It's flashy.
Very. This isn't a covert utilitarian strike. It is a grand orchestrated performance.
And the performance plays out on the cards themselves.
Yes, the activation.
Samuel opens a golden deck and extracts two cards. They are completely black. One has the word Joker written in stark red text, and the other is marked Queen.
Standard playing card archetypes.
Exactly. But as he flicks the metallic cards in his stiff hands, the surface of the cards activates. They function like high-resolution screens, displaying video-like images.
The integration of dynamic digital video onto elemental, solid gold playing cards is just a beautiful piece of speculative technology.
It really is.
It bridges the ancient elemental weight of gold with hyper-modern display tech.
But the images displayed on these beautiful golden cards are pure, unadulterated horror.
Yeah, they're gruesome.
The card labeled Queen displays a grotesque woman in a vibrant red dress, and blood is actively dripping from her mouth. The card labeled Joker shows something even less human, a figure that is described as blacker than black, pulsating with darkness.
Unsettling.
And beneath these terrifying looping videos, digital text types out, identifying them as targets. The bloody woman is Jezebel, and the pulsating darkness is Nimrod.
This is the culmination of the author's genre collision. We really have to unpack the theological and historical weight of these specific targets.
Definitely.
Because the author expects the reader to understand the severity of these names.
We all know the basics of these archetypes from Sunday school or cultural osmosis, you know. But I want to dive into the specific visual translation the author is doing here.
Let's do it.
Let's look at Jezebel first. We know her historically as the Phoenician princess who married King Ahab. And she is universally recognized in literature as the archetype of corruption, false prophecy, and the violent suppression of the divine order.
Right.
But the author doesn't give us a historical portrait. They give us a grotesque woman in a red dress, dripping blood.
Well, by focusing on the grotesque and the bloody, the author bypasses her political history and focuses entirely on her mythological resonance and her violent demise.
Right, her death.
Yes. In the biblical text, Jezebel's death is exceptionally brutal.
She was thrown from a window, right?
Thrown from a window, trampled by horses, and consumed by dogs.
Yikes.
The dripping blood on the playing card is a continuous looping echo of that violence.
That makes sense.
And the red dress is a well-established literary signifier for seduction, luxury, and sin. Think of the Whore of Babylon archetype.
Right, right.
The author is taking ancient theological bloodshed and mapping it perfectly onto the visual language of a horror movie.
It makes her a visceral threat, not just a historical concept. And mapping her onto the Queen card makes perfect thematic sense.
Yes, she is the corrupted matriarch.
The poisonous royal.
Exactly.
But then we have Nimrod, mapped onto the Joker card. The description of his target video is deeply unsettling. It says, blacker than black, pulsating with darkness. He isn't even depicted as a human being.
Which is a fascinating interpretive choice by the author.
Yeah.
Nimrod is one of the oldest archetypes of human rebellion. Genesis describes him as a mighty hunter, and extra-biblical tradition universally credits him with the construction of the Tower of Babel.
Right, the tower reaching to heaven.
He is the original architect of mankind's attempt to build a technological structure to pierce the heavens and usurp divine authority.
So why depict the architect of Babel as a pulsating black void? If he's a builder, why not show him as a giant or a king?
Because the author is translating ancient theology into the language of astrophysics.
Oh.
Nimrod represents the ultimate rebellion against the light of creation. By describing him as blacker than black, pulsating with darkness, while Samuel is physically traveling through deep space, the author is metaphorically turning Nimrod into a black hole.
A gravitational anomaly that consumes light.
Precisely. A black hole is the ultimate destructive force in the cosmos. It's a place where the laws of physics break down and light cannot escape. It is the perfect sci-fi analog for an ancient king who tried to tear down the heavens. He is no longer a human king. He has become an ontological threat to the universe itself, an active pulsating absence of light.
That is brilliant.
And assigning him to the Joker card reinforces this. The Joker is the wild card. It's the variable that operates outside the standard rules of the deck.
And Nimrod operates outside the divine order.
Exactly.
This completely recontextualizes Samuel's mission. If we pull all these threads together, the 9mm pistol, the voice-activated firmament, the controller of the 12 disciples, and the golden playing cards targeting the architects of biblical rebellion, what is the actual mechanical reality of this universe?
It portrays a reality where spiritual warfare is not a metaphor.
Right.
We often use phrases like battling our demons or fighting spiritual battles as psychological or ethical frameworks.
Right? Yeah, as metaphors for personal struggles.
But in this text, the author has literalized that concept. Spiritual forces, ancient archetypes of rebellion and corruption, are physical entities occupying physical space in the cosmos.
They are real.
And because they occupy physical space, they can be hunted.
Yeah.
They require kinetic bullets, Kevlar vests, and tactical operations to be neutralized. It is a stunning fusion of hard military science fiction with apocalyptic theology.
It really is. It takes the abstract struggle of good and evil and turns it into a gritty assassination protocol across a nebula. And what astounds me is the sheer velocity of this narrative. If we step back and look at the timeline of the text we just analyzed, the density is staggering.
It's so fast.
Every single sentence is a load-bearing structure for this universe.
The economy of language is ruthless.
In the span of what is arguably 2 or 3 minutes of real time for the character, Samuel transitions from a helpless, gasping victim, strapped down and drowning in panic inside a moth-infested coffin,
right,
into a fully armored, tactically aware operative standing in the void of space, holding a golden deck of assassination targets that read like a hit list for the apocalypse.
And that transition is a testament to the power of unconstrained genre blending.
It really is.
The author didn't just tell a linear sci-fi story. They violently collided distinct aesthetic systems.
Yeah, they smashed them together.
They took the decay and moral ambiguity of a noir thriller, injected the cold, lethal expansion of a space opera, and anchored the entire structure with the terrifying weight of ancient myth.
It's incredible.
It creates an atmosphere that demands active engagement from the reader because the rules of the world are constantly mutating.
It keeps you entirely off balance, mirroring Samuel's own disorientation. You are never allowed to get comfortable with the reality you're presented with.
No, never.
And as we conclude this deep dive, I want to pivot from the text itself and leave you, the listener, with a philosophical question built on what we've unpacked today.
It's the ultimate question of how we interact with systems of control.
Exactly. Consider Samuel's position. The text drops us into his mind at the exact moment of his awakening.
Right.
He possesses no memory of how he got into the coffin. He doesn't know who strapped him down. He retains his name, his tactical breathing exercises, and the ability to read ancient Hebrew, but he is completely stripped of context.
Completely blank.
Yet, the moment he finds the 9mm and the golden cards, he accepts the reality of the mission.
He does.
He gears up. He doesn't spend time screaming into the void, asking who put the moths in his pod.
Well, he complies because the mission parameters provided in the armory are the only structural truths available to him.
Right.
He adopts the purpose assigned to him because the alternative is to face the incomprehensible vastness of the nebula with no identity at all.
But think about the terrifying implications of that compliance. If you woke up tomorrow completely immobilized in a stasis pod, and upon breaking the glass, you found yourself handed an encrypted, violent mandate that completely defied your understanding of physics and reality.
What do you do?
Yeah, what would your mechanism of survival be? Would you simply put on the vest, load the 9mm, and blindly follow the instructions blinking on the golden cards?
Or do you fight the system?
Right. Or would you reject the assigned targets, leave the armory untouched, and start walking toward the front of the train to find the driver?
It is the fundamental tension between accepting the destiny you were handed, no matter how absurd, and fighting to reclaim your agency in a universe that has actively stripped it from you.
And that is a question you have to answer for yourself when the foundational architecture of your reality shatters, and you find yourself standing naked on a translucent floor, staring out into the freezing, muddy waters of a starry void. Keep looking closer at the narratives around you, everyone. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.